I felt like every time I almost had hope, it would just slip through my fingers. And I ended up in this office where I am right now. I have like a whole side over here where I have a sofa and a coffee table with, you know, gold painted inlay on it. All the trappings of success here in my multi-million dollar law firm. I found myself face down on the carpet, sure that my only option was to end my life.
What if story is the answer to our crises of meaning and belonging, to our impulse to heal our lives and help others, to our desire and drive to leave this world better than we found it? Now, we love good stories. In fact, we're kind of obsessed, not just with the stories themselves, but with the stories behind the stories. Their oddly perfect timing, the healing process they provoke in their authors, and their capacity to catalyze individual and collective change. And we love exploring these with writers, thought leaders, entrepreneurs, healers, parents, and others. Tune in to hear these stories behind the stories and entertain with us the real possibility that whether you are a teller or a consumer, story is always offering or leading us to an answer. Have you ever felt hopeless? Catherine Hammond took us to school, or maybe church, on the definition of hope in this episode. She challenged our culture's inaccurate and even risky proposed definition, helping us to explore how we've individually subscribed to it and suffered unnecessarily as a result. Tune in to hear Catherine share her amazing story of redefining hope for herself and the rest of us. You'll hear her list many of the lies that most of us believe about hope and how those increase our suffering. And finally, and maybe most exciting, she offers a truer definition of hope, which it continues to carry her as she faces life's inevitable challenges. I'm telling you, you're going to need a good hot cup of sips for this one while Catherine unravels your ideas about hope and opens up a whole new possibility for you. Welcome to Sips of Story Insanity, where we talk about the stories behind the stories with authors, speakers, thought leaders, healers, parents, and more. My team, my son, Aaron.
Hello.
My sister, Alyssa, who couldn't be here today, and my clients turned friends turned team members, Teddy.
Hi, y'all.
And Lori.
Hi, everyone.
And Carlin.
Hello.
Are here to make sure that we get the most delicious sips of story insanity out of this experience. Today, we have Catherine Hammond with us. She is an award-winning attorney, life transition guide, and the author of Hopeless. After a childhood marked by trauma, a series of devastating crises ultimately brought her to understand the true nature of hope. Today, Catherine's primary focus is helping individuals, families, and executive teams navigate challenges and thresholds of all kinds. Mother of two daughters and Mimi to three granddaughters, when she's not spending time with her girls, you'll find Catherine hiking near her Colorado home, traveling, or writing her next book. Ooh, I can't wait to ask about the next book, but let's talk about the first one first. Thanks for being here, Catherine.
So good to be here with all of you.
Yeah, so we met briefly a few years ago. Mm-hmm. And then stayed connected over social media. And I kind of lost touch with you. And then I started to see some of the posts that you had leading up to the launch of this book. I was like, wow, this lady, she really gets it. Like, I couldn't imagine some of the stories that you were sharing just in the post without having read the book. I was thinking, I need to interview this lady. Like, I need to know what her book writing process was like. Because I could tell from what you were posting that you were going to play full out with the stories. And you know, the situation, the challenge that you were facing with your husband, I was just thinking, oh my heavens, I can't imagine like navigating all of that and writing a book. So I'd love to start with, where did this book idea come from? Where were you when it kind of told you that it had to be written?
Well, I was a little girl when I first knew that I wanted to write, but the first seed that was planted for a book about my life was in 1999 or 2000. I was coming out of a terrible marriage, and I called in to, there was a radio talk show host who was doing his daily show, and the topic that day was suicide. And so I called in and we were talking about some interactions that I had had with people who had died by suicide or some other things. And I ended up sharing my story with him. And he told me, he was a psychologist, and he told me three times that I had to write a book. And I had wondered if my story might be worth telling beyond, you know, just my little inner circle. And that really planted a seed. And yet that was 20 some years ago now. And I had a whole lot more learning and living to do before I or the book was anywhere near ready, if a book is ever really ready.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, if a book is ever really ready, we all, having written books, we all know that, especially at the end, how challenging it is to determine whether the thing is done, not perfect, but done and ready. But, you know, to your point with the story, so much more life to live, this idea that there was more to learn before you got into the process of even writing the book. So when did you decide, okay, now it's time? What was it that actually made you feel like it's time to put pen to paper?
I started writing a memoir probably 8 years ago, and I was really digging into that. And by that point, the word hope had really become prominent in my life, in my mind, in my heart. And so I knew that hope was a theme, but I was kind of stuck on the memoir format because I have had a lot of interesting things happen in my life. And so I was writing along very, very slowly. And then in 2020, I had a coach mentor say to me, you know, I think you're dancing around the message by writing it in a memoir. I think you need to go straight to the message.
Wow.
And 2020, as we all know, like, things were, old ways of being and doing and living were being pulled apart. And so I listened and I let go of everything that I had written previously and started afresh with a clear knowledge that this was going to be simply an exploration of the true nature of hope, which I have danced with for many, many years now, and had come to understand at a level that I had found to be helpful for me and for everybody with whom I had a conversation about hope. And so I focused on the message now, which is really the important part, and used my story as an illustration wherever I thought it was helpful.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. Yeah. And I thought it does feel like both. It feels very memoir-esque, but also very well-structured in the sense of delivering a very clear message. So tell us a little bit more about this idea of hope, because it was really funny as I opened up your book and it was just those first few questions of how do you define it? I just love that, you know, because I think that we take words for granted and what they mean. And we have all of these definitions that we've subscribed to because of our culture, our religion, or our family system. And so it was really funny. I was thinking, my first brush with the word hope, I was reminded of the Bible verse, faith, hope, and love. And so I was really working to sort it out before I even started reading the book to see, what do I actually think it is? So I'm curious about your message and that journey of being able to articulate you wrestling with that term.
Before we go into my journey, feels important to preface this with the fact that I don't know about other dictionaries, but the Oxford American Dictionary specifically says that it is not here to tell us how to use words. It's simply a reflection of how words have been used in the past. And so that really gave me freedom to take hope, a word that I thought I knew, and explore what it really is. And I think the definition that life gave to me is a much more accurate definition. So for me, hope growing up in a situation with lots of chaos and neglect and abuse and trauma, I thought that hope was that thing when everything in your world externally looks pretty good and you can see that you are okay and that things are going to get better in the future. And that's the dictionary definition, and there are of course a number of different definitions, but the most common one is around a confidence that our circumstances are going to get better in the future, which is great if your circumstances happen to look like they're going to get better in the future. But for many of us, in many situations, either we can't see that our circumstances are going to get better, or they're not going to get better in the traditional sense in which we think about better. Terminal cancer, there are a whole bunch of things that just don't, that doesn't really fit with the way we measure better. And so I had spent my life trying to catch this hope and trying to do all the right things and be all the right things and, you know, tried relationships. If I just get the right relationship, then I'll finally have hope and be able to hold on to it. And I tried a lot of relationships and none of them gave me lasting hope. And then I turned, you know, to, you know, professional endeavors and professional success, and things kept happening with that too. And I felt like every time I almost had hope, it would just slip through my fingers. And I ended up in this office where I am right now. I have like a whole side over here where I have a sofa and a coffee table with, you know, gold painted inlay on it. All the trappings of success here in my multi-million dollar law firm, I found myself face down on the carpet, sure that my only option was to end my life. We were not doing well financially for a season in 2013. And payroll day came, and one of my employees, her payroll check was going to be held by the bank because there wasn't enough money to cover it. And I really, in that moment, because I had believed the dictionary definition of hope, a confidence that our circumstances are going to get better in the future, I didn't have that. Our revenue had been going down for a few months, and I didn't see my way out of this. And I had a whole team of people here who were counting on me, the way I saw it, to do all the right things so that they could go home with paychecks. And I came very, very close to ending my life that day, but I had learned enough to know that often, okay, every single time I had ever felt like the world was going to end, if I got a semi-decent night's sleep the next morning, things would look better. And so I decided to wait one day. And I came face to face with my definition of hope that day. Woke up the next morning and things looked slightly brighter. I thought, okay, well, I already had the money to cover that person's paycheck, and you know, things looked okay. And within 6 months, I was on an airplane, and I put my seat in the recline position, and I pull out Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, which one of the best books ever, probably most of you have read it. And I start reading about how Viktor was in the concentration camps, worst situation that I can imagine as a human being. And yet he did not lose hope. And the dictionary definition comes up against the dictionary definition of hopeless. If we are hopeless, it means the floor is literally falling out from under us. But the hope definition is a little bit lighter. Sometimes it's just a wish. And I was like, wait a second, these don't really go together, as I'm reading Viktor Frankl and realizing he didn't lose that sense of hope in the worst circumstance imaginable. Apparently, it's not actually our circumstances that determine our hope, nor our sense of hope. And that was 2013. I started playing with that. I chewed on it. I wrestled with it, as all of the things that have transpired in my life just since 2013 have happened. My oldest granddaughter was born in 2016, and she was born almost 3.5 months early, was dancing between life and death for 3 months on a daily basis. And the journey that I had been on with hope had brought me to a place where there was not a single moment where I felt like I had lost hope, even when she would stop breathing and her heart would stop beating and she would be blue and limp and lifeless and they would take her away. I didn't feel that same sense of, I have lost all hope, the floor is literally falling out, I can't survive this, that I had experienced before. And so for me, the definition of hope eventually evolved to a deep knowing that I am okay and I will be okay no matter what happens next. And okay, it is, in a bigger sense, doesn't mean that I'm going to live forever. It doesn't mean that those I love will live forever. Okay, meaning the floor will not drop out. The life that I have lived will still have meaning even when my life ends. The lives of those around me, even when they end, will still have meaning, still have an impact. They will still be with me. The world will keep spinning, even if what I consider to be the worst thing imaginable happens. And I can have the sensation of being okay, no matter what happens.
Yeah, it was so powerful because I remember that scene that you wrote about with your granddaughter. And also, I think the one that was even more palpable for me was the one where your husband was in the emergency room. And it did bring up all of this conversation around people who learn how to hold on to hope and have that sense of it's going to be okay. It brought up this whole bunch of questions around, what do you do with the people around you who think that you're totally, completely out of your mind? You should be completely stressed out. You should be curled up in the fetal position. You know, that whole piece around not just what do you do with them as the person going through a situation like that, because I've been that person and I've wondered, like, it makes me check my own reality. Like, I'm okay, right? I'm okay. Like, why is everyone else? But as people who are working to support someone in that space, like the family member who showed up or the friend who stops by the hospital and they see you in that state, what are the things that can be said or done on both ends to make this whole thing okay? Because I love that that was one of the main things that actually made me reach out to you on social media to have this conversation was this, like, it's not about, there's no bypassing here. It's not that I'm not scared. It's not that I'm not hurting. It's not that I wouldn't bawl my eyes out if I lost this person, but there's this other thing happening. So how do you, when you think about supporting people who are in that state, who are wondering, like, how do I convince other people that it's actually
hurting? Right. Right. It's a tricky position. And it wasn't until I was writing the book that I really started to get clarity on all the rules that we have set up as a society for ourselves and other people about when we're supposed to feel hopeful. You know, if somebody is in crisis, you know, potentially on their deathbed, we're not supposed to feel hopeful. If somebody has just died, it's okay to not feel hopeful. But a couple months after somebody dies, you're supposed to feel hopeful again. Like, there's all of this stuff that we put on ourselves and society puts on us. And so to the person who is in a precarious position with yourself or with a loved one, your job is to take care of you. Your job is to take care of you and be there if you're with somebody who is the one in an immediate crisis, to be there with them. That's it. We have to stop worrying about what everybody around us thinks, because it detracts from our most important job, which is being there with the person who's at the center of the crisis and making sure that we can still show up tomorrow in a good way, which means we have to take care of our physical, mental, and emotional well-being. So we have to begin to ignore that. And I think a lot of people who are in crisis are able to do that suddenly in a way that isn't so easy when it's not a crisis. For the people who are coming in from the outside, curiosity is the most important tool that we have for anybody going through anything. What is this like for you is a great question. And there is no wrong place for anybody to be. Noticing the ways that we have put expectations on things, noticing the expectations that I have for this other person who I think should be in any other place, letting that go and sticking with curiosity as the primary centerpiece. What is this like for you? What do you need? I'm here with you. And reassuring them that you don't need them to be in any particular place.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that. It's amazing how much this all comes back to presence, right? Sure. Being able to be present to everything that's happening. Yes, there's this horrible thing happening that I'm not sure how it's going to turn out and what my life will look like in a few hours, let alone a few days, right? And there's also this other thing that I know, and being able to be present to all of it, whether you're in it or supporting someone through it. So
yeah. And back to the definition of hope, I also believe that hope has an energetic component, that it is a wellspring that was planted inside every single one of us. It's our core, part of our core state. Mm-hmm. And once I realized that, I was able to let that carry me when everything outside of me looked like this roller coaster. I can sit back and rest into that without worrying about the roller coaster going on externally.
Yeah. Yeah, I love how you articulated the lies about hope and the truths about hope. And I would love for you to share some of those and just hear from everybody, because it was it was confronting for me to read through it on some of those pieces where I was like, wow, there are some areas of my life where I can see myself still subscribed to this version of hope, this definition. Mm-hmm. So would you mind sharing?
Most of us have bought into these, and I compare it in the book to, you know, like the old flat earth theory. And at some point, everyone figured out that old theory just was not right. And that has definitely been the case for me with hope. So one of the lies that we have been taught by very well-intentioned people who simply never knew any different is that hope is based on our circumstances, as we talked about. So hope instead is a wellspring inside. What's going on out here doesn't determine whether or not I have hope. It might look cloudy, but just like with the sun on a cloudy day, it doesn't mean that the sun has disappeared. It just means it's cloudy right now and I can't see or feel the sun. Hope is the same way. Another thing that I believed all of my life, and that most people, everyone I've ever talked to about it has believed, is that hope is a thing that we either have or don't have. It's like a commodity that gets eaten up if you use it all up like a block of cheese. And I have experienced it as a wellspring, and ever flowing wellspring. There is no such thing as running out of hope. There is no such thing as hopeless. We think we're hopeless. And that's where it gets dangerous, because for everyone, on at least every English speaker, being hopeless means it's all over. And so thinking that we're hopeless causes all kinds of misery, causes all kinds of problems in relationships, in our work, it holds us back. And for many people, it causes us to end our own lives because we believed something that wasn't true. Another lie that I talk about in the book is that hope is about the future. That's what we think of when we think of traditional hope. And Frank Ostasevsky, one of my very favorite thinkers and authors, talks about this in his book. He was the first person who reinforced my thinking about hope in writing. He calls this mature hope. So hope, as far as being future-based, is kind of a fallacy. It's false hope because we don't actually know what's going to happen in the future. All we have are guesses or thoughts about what's going to happen in the future. All we really have is now. And the entire purpose of hope is to carry us through now into the next moment. Hope really has nothing to do with the next moment. It's about carrying us from this moment to the next one. Another lie that I talk about in the book is that hope is only for the lucky ones, for the special club. And I grew up, you know, with a single mom who was, you know, from my perspective when I was growing up, I thought she was, you know, back in those days, we called it crazy. She was very depressed. I didn't know she had been hospitalized for depression before she had any kids, and again, after my younger brother was born. And that morphed into early onset Alzheimer's disease. So by the time I was a teenager, she couldn't remember things. We didn't know anything about Alzheimer's. And I was just embarrassed. And things kept happening in my world. And I felt like the unlucky one. And it looked like everybody else out there had, you know, perfect family, perfect lawn, perfect, you know, all the perfect things. And they all looked hopeful. And I thought that they had hope because of all of those things in their worlds. And I thought that hope wasn't for me. And it took me, you know, a lot of years and working through my old stories to figure out that hope is available, accessible to all of us. It's not just the people who have certain things that give them a better, easier start. I think some people have easier access because of their upbringing, their race, there are a number of things that can make hope a little bit easier to access. And when the rubber meets the road, it's not until, you know, the rug has been pulled out from under us in some way, metaphorically, that we really come to wrestle with hope ourselves and find what real hope is. And every single one of us is in that same game together, no matter what your background, financial status, any of the other things that can make it harder to access for some folks. No matter who you are, what's true for you in your external world, hope was still planted inside of you. Some people have to do more work to clear the clouds to find it. And we all have it.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that. I love that idea so much. This idea of, we see people who are so resilient. And I know one of the things that you talked about in the book was the connection between resilience and hope. And because I've been having the opportunity for the last few years to study resilience through one of my clients and all of the work that I'm doing with her. And so it's really funny when you start to dig into those neural pathways and the neurobiology of how does one build resilience? You know, Carlin, I think you said it this one time, all it really takes is just one human in your childhood, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, one, because I had done some research into resilience a few years ago for some talks I was doing. And essentially what it boiled down to is basically opportunities to make mistakes and resolve them. So that builds a skill, but in or with the support of at least one reliable adult. And what I really loved about that at the time, based on the research I was doing or the project I was working on, is that it's great if that one adult is a parent, but sometimes it is not going to be a parent. Sometimes that one reliable, safe adult may not be available even in the house and in your family, but maybe it's a teacher or somebody at church or an aunt and uncle or a therapist, whoever. But I remember thinking that that is hopeful. Like that feels really hopeful that there's somebody out there, or there could be somebody out there to offer that kind of safe guidance that may not be available in lots of other spaces in a person's life.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know for me, that adult came in bits and pieces of different people. There was a little bit that I got from a school counselor and a little bit that I got over here, and there was nothing consistent, but I consistently had bits of adult support.
Yeah. Yeah. And the thing that I love the most about that is the understanding of the privilege and the responsibility that we have when we know that, of being present with people, like realizing that, you know, the little kid who's getting screamed at by her mom at Target is Mayor. may have not happened a million times for me. You know, like a moment of presence with a child, knowing that this thing going on in the Target bathroom is probably just a sliver of what this child is experiencing anywhere, right? And so if I can compliment her outfit or something, just to give her a little something from another adult, like maybe that's a seed of this, you know, hope that her entire world isn't going to be like this forever, that there are other humans who can be with her in that state. So
yes, yes, yes.
Yeah.
Every one of us needs those little reminders. I still need them as an adult.
Yep. Me too. Me too. Carlin, what is this bringing up for you around your, because we've talked about hope so much and the project that you're working on, mm-hmm. and as it relates to, you know, the people that you've supported over time and the mental health mm-hmm. space, what does this bring up for you around these definitions?
So many questions and comments. I love it. I mean, I think I've not used the word hope in that way before, but more like an internal security, right? The sense of like, I know I'm okay and I'm going to be okay. And that is internal and separate from anything that could be happening on the outside. And this is such a like I work with, and I have for a very long time, with the very serious mentally ill population and a lot with their family. So the family work, this sense of being, or saying like, this is hopeless. Like, this is hopeless. What are we ever going to do? Is such a primary theme in working with some of these families, most of them really. So I've seen it as my kind of job and my role in my programs to help people. I call it like reclaim hope. And kind of like what you're saying, Catherine, like it's not gone. It's not a thing that left you or the world. We're just having a hard time accessing it right now. And I've always thought about hope, like even when you were first talking, I'm like, I don't know, how do I define hope? I don't know if I've ever really thought about it as something based on circumstance, but I love the idea that it isn't. I think like what we've talked about a lot, Amanda, and this definitely shows up in the book, is this idea of belief that there are other possibilities available than what might be happening right now in this moment, or other possibilities for meaning that might be available that you didn't walk in this door with. And again, I talk a lot about that with families who come in saying, you know, my kid got diagnosed with schizophrenia at 17 and here he is 27 and things have gotten worse, not better. What are we ever going to do, right? It gets attached to schizophrenia or some of the things that are happening outside versus what, you know, what is available inside to help stay kind of stabilize and move people through. The thing, I had a question for you though, Catherine, when you were talking about the sensation, you like put your hands like this. And I think about that a lot because I ask people a lot, where do you feel that in your body? Because people can sometimes get a concept in their head. Okay, hope isn't about circumstances. Hope is about this thing that lives inside, sometimes behind the clouds. But they won't have a bodily sensation of what that feels like. So I'm curious if you, like what your experience is with that or how you've seen that show up in your work.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, first of all, wow, your work with the mentally ill and families of people who are mentally ill, I really want to honor that because it's something that's so prevalent and there's so little support for people in the world. And that's exactly where, like, there may not be a fix for somebody's mental illness. And so helping people take the hope off of the fix, the problem, and going back to experiencing hope. For me, it is very much something that happens in the body. And so I have a toolkit in the book, and a lot of it, most of it maybe all of it, is about bringing you back to an embodied experience. That is the center of it for me. And yeah, my years of originally contemplative prayer, meditation, really gave me some basic tools so that then when, you know, my husband had a huge tumor that burst his intestine a few years ago, when that happened, I was able to come back to my body and simply breathe and be with it without really needing it to be fixed. And Dr. David Drake says, you know, a problem is a reality that we don't like. Mm-hmm. We're having this experience. We had the tumor experience. I've had a lot of experiences, and letting myself come back to my body and let go of trying, because that resistance is so much of where, I mean, that brings us into a tension, a contraction, you know, with our minds and with our bodies. As soon as we start to push against whatever is happening, it's the relaxing into it that helps us be with it. And that's where all the possibility comes from.
I love that, like the idea that you can separate it, right? Mm. Like an external circumstance could very well appear hopeless, right? Or appear unfixable. It may in reality not be fixable, but that doesn't mean this internal sense of okayness or the idea that things are going to be better or I'll feel differently at some point. Like it still exists independent from something on the outside falling apart, because that does happen sometimes.
Right.
Like you're saying, I mean, many of the families I've worked with over the years have, you know, they've lost their loved one to suicide or addiction or any number of, you know, horrible things that happen. And come in looking for something, right? And how often it feels like it's on the outside.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Another one of the lies that I talk about in my book is that hope is only for the big things in life, the mental illness, the unemployment, the, you know, financial crisis, whatever it is, the cancer, and not for the little things. There's a deep connection between the way that our lives are going in every area and our relationship with hope. If I think my hope is based on my circumstances, which is what most of us believe, whether we've ever been able to articulate it or not, then when my spouse does something that doesn't thrill me, I am more constricted in how I dance with that. I'm more constricted in how I interact with him. I'm more likely to feel the need to try to control things, control him, or control the way things go in our interaction about it. It ends up constricting us in every area. If I know that I will be okay no matter what, then I can say, you know what, when you just did that, I had the craziest experience. I started to feel like all that stuff from when I was little, when I was afraid people were leaving me, I started to feel like you were going to leave me, which is very different from you stupid whatever, you know, why did you do that? I'm not afraid of having that feeling. I'm not afraid of having the interaction. And, you know, as a business owner, I'm not afraid to take a risk. As an executive, I'm not afraid to take a risk because I know that risk is part of the game and I will be okay. Even if this doesn't go the way that I think it should go, even if people get mad at me, my okayness doesn't come from, you know, that I'm still trying to get rid of the little box in which I've, you know, spent my life trying to do all the perfect things so that I can be okay, you know, acceptable to the world. It helps us release that and really unfold ourselves. And that's where the beautiful stuff comes. I had the most beautiful experience on Facebook of all places yesterday. I had made a post yesterday morning and I started out with a statement around, you know, I'll never forget the slumber party in junior high school when I went home before dark with tears streaming down my cheeks. And I noticed a little while later that one of the two gals who had hosted that slumber party had liked my post. And I happen to be friends with both of them. I mean, Facebook friends, not real friends. And I took a risk and I commented and I tagged both of them. And I said, I promise next time I'll be more fun. And I was talking about how the stories we carry, and I was talking about the story I carried about always being alone and not being wanted and all of that. So one of them commented back and said, oh my gosh, I feel terrible. What did we do? And she, you know, she was having a hard time with it. And then the other one commented. And she said, as soon as I read those words, and she repeated my words, it took me back to that day. She said, that day has haunted me. I knew that you didn't feel safe or wanted. And I was not in a place where I was willing or ready to do anything about it. Your story about being alone and unwanted collided with my story about being flawed and that I would always be flawed. Her vulnerability in saying that to me on Facebook blew me away. It was hope that enabled me to put the original post out there and then tag them in the comments. It felt a little bit risky to me. I didn't know what was going to happen. I was well aware it could go poorly. And it ended up being the most beautiful, healing experience I've ever had on social media. But I knew I would be okay. And she knew that she would be okay, no matter what I thought of what she shared.
Yeah, that's incredible. And when you're talking about these stories, you know, one of the things that I saw in the book that I thought was so beautifully communicated was the generational pickup of the stories, right? Like how these things get transmitted, that first scene of your mom running out of the house and I can't handle this or whatever that is, right? Like how they get so deep in there that then we hear ourselves say the same thing one day. Like, is that true or is that just something that I picked up? And so one of the questions that I had as I was reading was, because you know, how old are your children now?
They are 30 and 32.
Okay. So this new awareness happened once they were outside of your house, right? Like they've kind of started their lives. And so my curiosity was, how would this knowledge of what hope is, like, what would you say to some of the parents who have the ability to shift these stories earlier, right? And understand that, like, I know that I have some terrible stories around hope that I'm trying to unravel and rewrite here. How would that have changed the experience for you and your kids had you known this earlier?
If I had known this and if I had done a lot more healing before I had kids, I was 25 and 27 when I had them. I had a lot of trauma that I had not worked out. It would be a totally different ball game. their childhoods would have been very different. My experience of parenting as a single mom would have been very different. And there have been times when I have felt, you know, some regret over that. And the reality is, I knew everything that I knew when I was 25 and 27 and mid-30s and all of that. And I did the best I could with all of that. And every single one of us is on our own journey. And so to, you know, younger mom, Catherine, to you who, you know, anybody listening who is parenting now, and you know that you're not living as fully and beautifully, and that there are some things that might be holding you back, some stories. And there are so many resources these days. Just take a step, whatever feels like the best next step to explore more of yourself and your stories. And then take the next step. There's nothing you need to fix, but just getting on the journey is what it's about. And I'm 57 now. I haven't worked it all out. I'm hoping in a wishing kind of sense that I have more time. It's like we're all works in progress, and every one of us is on the journey that we're supposed to be on. We don't need to be fixed. There is no fixing. We just journey.
Yeah. And I thought that was one of the really beautiful parts of your story, is to see how even without this awareness, even as you were struggling with your own circumstances and challenges and sorting out how you felt about hope through this process, like one of the things that was one of those sub narratives going through was how you were shifting the narrative in your family. You were being so present with your daughters. You were, you know, I mean, it was really, really beautiful. Those scenes, I'm still emotional. I was reading them this morning, right? Of like being with your kid and realizing that you're able to undo or rewrite some of those things for them. Even without everything that you knew 10 years later or 20 years later, whenever that comes. But it's that part that makes it, I think that's my point. Like, it's the presence, not the ideas, right?
Right, right.
It's the presence, not the definitions. It's, you know, yeah. All of those things can be sorted out when we have that connection, which is
right.
One of those things. I don't feel like that was exactly what the goal of the book was, but it was one of those really sweet pieces that came through around the generational stories and how you allowed the reader to see how that was shifting even before you had this awareness around hope.
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that. And it's interesting because the last couple of years, like, our relationships with our children continue to evolve. And, you know, even my daughters, you know, every year our relationship evolves, you know, with each of them. And I didn't do things perfectly. I was, you know, in a lot of ways a mess when they were little, and I planted seeds. Mm-hmm. And I was always pursuing growth and wholeness. And they now, at a much younger age, are so far ahead of where I was. They both are married to men who love them. They both got married early. It worried me because I wasn't able to choose well early. And they are, in so many ways, so far ahead of where I was. And that feels like the biggest success to me as a mom. And they are raising kids in a way that is much more conscious and much less chaotic than the way that I raised my kids.
Yeah.
So it's a slow process over the generation.
It is.
If we can make some change.
Yeah. Were there any parts when you were writing that were especially hard to write? Or do you feel like you had done a lot of the processing? Because you clearly did a lot of work between 2013 and when you started writing in 2020. Mm-hmm. So were there any places where you noticed feeling stuck or those types of things around the story?
Where I struggled sometimes feeling stuck was, how do I put it together? Because the message was so important to me. And I never thought about, you know, the lies about hope or the truths about hope in such a structured way. And it was actually in the summer of 2020, I was asked to give a presentation on hope. That's where I came up with the lies and the truths, and that, you know, became the basis for the book. So the stuckness for me was mostly in really trying to make sure that this was helpful for the reader, not just healing for me to write, because I think it's always healing for us to write, and creating is one of the tools in my toolkit. Creating is, I think, the most healing thing there is. That it's the next step in the metamorphosis, is the creating anything new. There were parts of the book that were very emotional for me to write, all of the things about my granddaughter, the things about Brian, the things that I put into the epilogue about Brian. I bawled my eyes out when I was writing all of that. And it felt important to me, both for me and for others because we're all going through stuff. We don't talk about the stuff that we're going through very much. I'm here to stand for doing more of that, sharing more of the messiness of the human story. That I think that's a big part of how we see and find our place in the world and our worth and our value, is seeing how we fit in to the bigger story. And we can't do that until we get real about the fact that we're all going through the same stuff.
Yeah.
Might be slightly different situations externally, but it's the same journey.
That's what I was thinking as I was reading, is there's this, the definition of hope, and it's pinched in by the other kind of cultural belief that we're going to arrive somewhere someday. And it's all going to be great and wonderful. And then life will not have any more suffering. It's like, where did that come from? Who started that? because that's what we're hoping. That's where the hope comes from, right? We're hoping for that time where we all get to stop suffering. But it's like, does that day ever come? Because, you know, everyone dies. Everyone loses. Everyone has challenges. Like, yeah.
It doesn't come in these bodies, for sure.
No.
Can I share? I'm sitting here with epiphanies and understandings going off. So part of my brand is truth, hope, and love. Hope is a very big part of my life. I had, in my childhood, I had an older couple that reached out, and they, in the nightmare of my life, they taught me faith. And he was a college professor teaching psycho-cybernetics. And together, one was my Sunday school teacher, and the, you know, together they gave me this beautiful thing on being able to imagine and believe and see things come. And, you know, so I, in the nightmare, in the dark of my life, I've always had a dream and would wake up in the morning when the sun would come up in my life, that dream would be a reality. So I've seen that as hope. Always that yonder star, the hope. Then in the 90s, I got cancer, and we were in a I was in a very hopeless feeling situation. My husband was laying on one side of the couch, a big sectional, and I was at the other, just our feet touching. And we couldn't answer the phone anymore. You know, we were just, it was dark. And all of a sudden I had a thought. All is well. Emmanuel. And in that moment, it was like this knowing that I'm not alone. No matter what happens, everything is going to be all right. It was this whole thing that just happened. The phone rang. I jumped up to get it. My husband's like, what are you doing? And I answered the phone, hello, you know? And then, so of course somebody's asking me how I'm doing. And I said, I am all is well, Emmanuel. Everything's going to be all right. All is well. And that became, that knowing that you're talking about. So I'm bringing all this up because I'm in a situation right now where I had this accident and I'm in pain, constant pain. And in that constant pain feeling, and not knowing if it's ever going to get better or how better is it going to get. I have felt without in not without hope, but I have felt hopeless, that feeling. And today, my daughter made me a sign several years ago that said, all is unfolding perfectly. And I have it front and center. Every time I walk out of my room, it's right there. I see it. And so I was walking out of my room and my husband was talking to me and I stood there and I was touching that, not comprehending what it was saying. I was just feeling the texture of it, you know, and just kind of like how cool that was. And as you're talking, I'm realizing, oh, this is a huge part of my brand. I'm always saying all is well, no matter what, all is well. That knowing, and I, through the course of this accident, it's been 6 weeks, I have been without that. Not that it was gone. I just somehow lost sight of it. And even, you know, like something having me just trace that sign was trying to bring me back to that knowing that all is well. All is unfolding perfectly, no matter what. That is the hope that's a part of my brand, that a piece of it that I hadn't even myself brought into it. I was more thinking yonder star, you know, without a vision, people perish. You've got to have, you know, hope, believe, celebrate, act as if, and there it comes, you know, that kind of almost right now in this moment feels airy, fairy, flighty, like, but oh my God, this is the hope that's a part of my brand, the grounding, the knowing, no matter what, everything's going to be okay. It is okay. All is well. So I bring that back to this aha, talking about vulnerability. Like, what makes vulnerability possible? How can you be vulnerable without hope, without that knowing? That no matter what, and a lot of us, you know, in are getting ready to launch books and launch this and launch that and put ourselves out there. And it's like the terror, you know, that I've experienced, you know, putting myself out on Facebook, putting myself out there, becoming vulnerable, like, oh, this is the answer. Hope, that knowing. That no matter what, all is well. It doesn't matter what happens. It doesn't matter who says what or who does what. I'm going to be okay. Everything's going to be okay. I am so, inspired and like ready to explode right now. I am so grateful for this conversation. I really am. I am so very grateful. It's going to be life-changing for me, Miss Catherine.
Patty, thank you so much for sharing that. For me, pain, this is, if it's not the last lie that I talk about in the book, it's one of the last lies that I hadn't mentioned. One of the lies that I believed was that pain and hope were mutually exclusive. When I was in deep pain, usually emotionally, but sometimes physically, it felt like this, you know, steel wall between me and hope. I think there's nothing like pain to bring us into like really wrestling with it. And what I hear you saying is, yes, you've had this head knowledge and you've had the grounding, the embodied grounding, and it sounds like they are coming together.
Yeah, it's a real reminder, because I've had a lot of emotion. I've been really emotional, you know, through this. And I thought when I was getting ready for this podcast, oh, we're talking about hope here. And I feel, oh, I don't know about hope. And I hope I don't cry. And because I'm usually the first one on the floor in tears. But like, I really am. It married two pieces of my belief systems together that I had never put together. And I knew them both each very well, but they just came together. And I think it's going to change a lot of things. I really do. I really thank you.
Thank you for sharing that. Yeah, I'm grateful for any seeds that I can help plant.
I, of course, want to know what my son is thinking over there about hope, because I just wonder, like, does this impact how you're feeling about some certain things that you're come through?
So like Teddy, like, it's like a really good reminder for me right now for where I'm at with some things. And, you know, actually, this is a conversation I had with myself a few years ago when I was coming up with an idea for a book or book series, and it just came out of nowhere. I wish I could remember what incited this thought. But the thing that came to me was that hope is just faith shrouded in doubts or in fear. It's kind of like my faith definition was the definition of your definition of hope, where it's like the, you know, hope is like this, you know, I hope this is going to happen. You know, I have my doubts, or maybe sometimes it's like, I do have hope and there's less doubts, but there's still a doubt, right? Like, I think it's going to be fine, but I'm not quite sure, versus faith being the conviction and the knowing, right, that it's going to be fine. So it's better to have faith than to have hope, because it makes you stronger. So this whole conversation is just fortifying that and like reminding me that clearly I need to, you know, have more faith in some things right now. And that it's kind of like, you know, that things happen for you and not to you. It's that whole conversation that we've been having, right? And right, the belief of being taken care of and being okay. And that if not, if something doesn't go the way you think it will or you want, you know, there's always something better and coming your way. And then maybe that falls apart too, right? But you always have the faith that, you know, it's like having faith in the seasons as well, right? Ups and downs and all arounds. So yeah, those are my thoughts.
Oh, lovely.
Really glad you mentioned faith, Erin, because that's what I've been sitting here thinking about is, you know, a couple of years ago, when I kind of picked up that mantra of, you know, embrace the moment. And that's kind of that I'm okay piece, you know, let's just embrace this and see what's gonna happen. But it will all be okay, all be good, no matter what, we'll make it through. But for me, I think of it more as faith. instead of hope. And maybe those words are more intertwined than what I recognized until this conversation, because I think about the trauma and different things that I went through as a child and then in my first marriage, and just, you know, the different things that happen to us all day, right? That are constantly going on. And I think that if I didn't have that faith, or, you know, Amanda knows, like, I call that my feisty shit side of myself, that part that I'm just never going to let go, because dang it, if somebody's going to knock me back down again. I think that that faith, that hope, they just are what propelled me to take that next step. That feisty side of me that says, you can't tell me I can't do that, you know? And that piece of what Amanda was talking about with seeing others, and just that seeing, just being seen and seeing others, is such an important way for us to reflect that hope for other people. And I'm so grateful. I bought your book. I started reading it. I'm not finished with it yet, but I am absolutely loving it. And I love the thought, that connection you put with, and I know I'm jumping all over the place. I got so many ideas just like screaming through my head here. But I love that idea of how we thought the world was flat, you know, we would fall off of it. And it was so definitive, you know? And so sometimes we think things are so definitive. And if we will just take that extra step and have that extra piece of faith or have that hope, we walk into a new light and we open up, you know, we see something that we couldn't see before. If that makes sense, you know, that light.
How sure did we used to be as a human race that the earth was flat? Like, we were really, really sure.
Right. And sometimes it seems like people are really, really sure that everything's going to fall apart. Mm-hmm. And there's no hope. And I can't see that. I can't grab that vision, because to me, there's always hope. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
And that for me is where taking it out of my mind, because my mind can only see so much, and the human brain is here, you know, largely to protect us. It's looking for every problem so that the problems can be solved and we'll be safe. But letting it come from just my mind and down into my body and experiencing it as a grounding in my body, there's no circumstance out there that can shake it out of my body, can shake it out of my mind, because my mind is limited and trained to see certain things and, you know, think if this happens, then disaster is coming. But my body knows a lot more.
Yeah. And that's where I have to remind myself to embrace that moment. You know, when I lose sight of that, is to embrace the moment, because I know internally it's going to be okay. Whatever this is, I just need to embrace it and run with it, because the grander scheme that's out there, we can't, if we don't move forward and we don't embrace it and we're fearful of it, then we lose, you know, that's what holds us back. Mm-hmm. And if we can move forward and have that faith and that hope, we can have experiences that we never thought possible.
So true.
Such a good conversation. And you know, I can't let you go without asking about this next book that you talked about in your bio. Is it related?
Yes, it is. So what currently, I'm interested in doing is diving more deeply into the relationship between hope and different aspects of life. The one that has been most present for me in different ways over the last 7 years, but especially right now. Is hope and illness. Because illness seems like a big problem that needs to be solved. And there are so many unique things about what happens in our relationship with hope and our relationship with other people. Our relationships to ourselves when there's a serious illness, either in ourselves or in a loved one. And my best friend died of leukemia, and my granddaughter was in the hospital, and my son-in-law had stage 4 tonsil cancer. And it's been one thing after another until now, my husband's incurable cancer. And that's where I'm living. And it's My husband describes it as a bittersweet place to live, and means that, you know, very much. The bitter is obvious, and the sweet, there's nothing that I want. There's nothing that I think most of us want more than like a real experience of being alive. And when we are staring at our mortality in the face, there's an aliveness that happens like nothing else. And so even in the middle of something that we would never choose, when we take hope off of the circumstances and find that fountain that is accessible no matter what, we're able to be with the bitter and the sweet and the bitter and the sweet and the in-between and the boring and all of the parts of life. But illness helps us dance with our mortality and with hope in a way that is pretty unique. So.
Wow. That sounds like an amazing project. Does he help you with the process? Like, is he part of your brainstorming, writing, editing? Like, is he involved?
He was involved late in this process. I didn't involve him early enough. He is a thinker, a philosopher. He helps me think. Last year, he was on chemo for 6 months. And so, you know, we weren't really able to have the kinds of conversations around my book that I would have loved to have had. So he will be, my desire is that he will be more involved in the next one. We don't know, you know, what's ahead for his journey, but that's my desire.
Sounds like a perfect duo for a book like this. Well, Catherine, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your story and helping us and our audience challenge their thinking around hope and hopefully drop into the experience of it. I'm sure that people are going to want to get a hold of you. So how can they do that? How can they connect with you?
Yeah. So first of all, there is a landing page for the book. It's hopeless-book.com. And on that landing page, if you scroll way down, there is a free gift for you. It is one of my very favorite practices in the whole world. It's how to have the best day of your life whenever you want. So if you're interested in that. And then I hang out on Instagram mostly. It's katherinehammond.life. I also have a website under the same name, katherinehammond.life. I play a little bit on Facebook as well. So you can reach out to me any of those places.
Perfect. All right. Well, thank you to our audience for listening to this episode of Sips of Story and Sanity. I'm sure that you loved what you heard. So please consider subscribing, leaving us a review, and maybe even sharing what got challenged for you around hope in this episode. We'd love to see those comments. I think that's a wrap for today. Thank you again, Catherine, and thank you to the team.